In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about how to run a paid advertising campaign. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 225. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
We got a nice tip from Josh Aronoff, and it's about using Todoist and email. And this ties into a discussion you and I have had a few times where I've mentioned that I would love for it to be able to basically reorder my my Gmail email and make it a to-do list. And he says, hey guys, love the show. I've been using Todoist lately, and they have a Chrome extension which lets you add a task from email and append the email to the task as a URL that goes back to that email. So if I have an email I need to respond to that I need to postpone, I can just make a task and click on it. So it essentially integrates the two. And I figured if anyone's using Todoist that this would be a good tip. And if you're interested in kind of being able to reorder your Gmail inbox, it could also be helpful.
That sounds really cool. It sounds very similar to what you're kind of doing manually right now with Trello.
Exactly.
Where you kind of send things
forward it over and then come back and search. Yep. Which is a little bit cumbersome. That works for me, but I could see this. If I was not using Trello, I would consider using something like this. We discussed the new EU VAT laws a couple weeks ago, and Ryan Delk from Gumroad dropped me a link to an email. We'll link it up in the show notes. It's actually a blog post, and it says how we're handling VAT at Gumroad. The nice part is if you are using Gumroad, they basically handle it all for you, so you don't have to worry about it. If you want to hear more about that, you can check it out in the show notes.
Very cool. Well, this past week, I went to a local photography studio and had some new photos done. So I took the time to update my social profiles. Clean shaven, a little bit lighter, and no glasses.
Yeah.
It was like $135 for the sitting fee and then $5 for each photo that I wanted. And there were 10 that looked good. So I just grabbed 10 in different poses and outfits and stuff like that. So
yeah, every couple years, it's nice to get a couple headshots done, you know. And I've actually done it. Last couple of headshots I've gotten, one was when we did a big family photo shoot and we hired a photographer to come out to our property and do different location shootings here, indoors and outdoors. And then I said, hey, can you just do a headshot while you're here? And then the other time was when I recorded that video course on how to hire a VA for your startup, which is startupvacourse.com. So it's nice to have a couple different ones you can rotate.
I figured I'd have something professionally done that I could actually use in more of a professional manner.
Right. So what are we talking about this week?
Well, today we're going to be talking about how to run a paid advertising campaign, but I don't think we've ever actually done an episode on walking through what it is that you should be doing, how do you compare different platforms, what sorts of things you should look at when you're going through that, what things you should document, things to pay attention to, things to avoid. And I thought that what we should do is we should walk through a lot of those things so that people understand kind of the process that we go through and can kind of learn from that and, you know, maybe offer some insight back onto the comments of the podcast. Share the things that we've gone through and what things we pay attention to because we think they're important.
I think our intent is to make this a little bit entertaining so that you actually want to listen to it, and B, keep it high level enough that it's something that is like evergreen content so that you could come back to it in the future if you wanted, but also that gives you like the mindset if you're going to start embarking on driving paid traffic, it gives you the mindset of how to kind of conceptualize all this.
So I think the first step in running a paid advertising campaign is to know what your target cost of acquisition is. If you don't know what your cost of acquisition is, you kind of need to guess what it is that you're going to aim for and use that as a guideline. Because when you start advertising on these different platforms, the cost of acquisition is going to vary dramatically between the different platforms. So know what it is, what your target is before you even start running the advertisements.
I'm going to give you a couple rules of thumb of how I would calculate or ballpark what I would use for my cost to acquire a customer. First thing I'd start with is to figure out what is the average lifetime value of a customer. And I'll throw out three scenarios. One is that you have a one-time purchase product. Let's say you have an ebook or you have a WordPress plugin or some downloadable software. You charge X dollars one time for it. Now, some people may buy that and then buy other things from you. But if you don't have a bunch of data that are easily at your fingertips, I would just ballpark it and say my lifetime value is going to tend to be just the dollar amount someone would pay me for that, right? So if I sell four different pieces of software for $40 each, I would say the lifetime value is going to be $40. Because I'm going to just say, you know, unless I know for a fact X amount of people go and buy multiple items, I'm going to say my one-time purchase is $40 and I'm going to start with that. If you have an e-commerce website, I would just look at my average order value. Again, if you have the data and you can go and say, well, this many people reorder on average and you can calculate it, that's fine. But if I was going to ballpark it, what is your average order value? And if you're a subscription service, so let's say your SaaS or your membership website, I would tend to ballpark membership websites are between 4 and 6 month lifetime. So you can, you know, to be on the low side, you might want to say, hey, it's 4 times my monthly fee. And SaaS tends to be between 5 and 10 until you've really hit product market fit. So I would, again, if you want to be on the low side and be more conservative, you could say 5 and 10 is not unrealistic for a reasonable service. So once you have that number, and you know, for some, if you're selling a $19 ebook, then your lifetime value is $19. And if you have a SaaS app that's $30 a month, then maybe it's $300 for that lifetime value. In general, you want to turn a profit, right? You don't want to break even unless you have a back end. And so if I was going to be trying to scale a SaaS app up eventually, I would probably say to acquire a customer, I don't want to spend any more than 1/3 of my lifetime value. And if I was going to try to acquire someone for a one-time purchase, you know, maybe you could creep up to 50% or 60%, but you don't want to go to 80 or 90% because then your profit margin is really, really low unless you are trying to build that list and sell more things down the line. That's a quick summary. There's obviously a very large topic of what to figure out what your target cost per acquisition should be, but that's how I think about it conceptually.
Yeah, I mean, you want your cost of acquisition to be as low as possible, but still at a point where you're going to be able to make money. And I think the other point to kind of drive home here is that just because you have a target cost of acquisition doesn't mean that over time, you're not going to be able to reduce that by kind of optimizing some of your different ads. Because when you first start out, you don't know what you're doing. And that's part of why you're testing some of these different platforms and strategies. And when you do that, over time, you will naturally get better at it, or at least hopefully you will get better at it. Sometimes the platform makes changes and they basically screw you over, or there's a lot of competition that comes in and there's really not a lot you can do about it at that point. Your long-term goal is to get better at it and thus drive your own costs down.
Yep. The rule of thumb I use is if I run ads, send them to a landing page and do what I'm trying to do, and I can get within 3x of my target cost per acquisition, then I continue, right? And then I try split testing and optimizing ads and doing other things. So that means if I can pay $50 to acquire a customer, and the first time I run an unoptimized campaign, you know, it's $150 or less, then I'm within target. But if I run it and it's $500 to acquire, meaning it's, you know, 10x, it's obviously possible that you could optimize into that, but that's where I tend to just back out and say, boy, this channel is not going to work for me. And I think this actually, you know, begs the question of like, well, what type of lifetime value do you need in order to be able to support paid acquisition? And it depends, B2C, B2B, and all that stuff. But in general, what I've seen is I don't know anyone who's making paid acquisition work profitably that doesn't have a lifetime value of around $100. And so if you are selling a $20 or $30 ebook, that's hard. If it's out of an ecosystem, you know, if it's not a loss leader, if you're actually trying to turn a profit on it, it's pretty tough with a $20 or $30 lifetime value. There are exceptions. Patrick McKenzie with Bingo Card Creator has done it. He's also very, very good. And he has spent a lot of time, and he's one of the best people at AdWords that I know. If you are in a niche where the clicks are at all expensive, then you are going to be paying easily $100 or more to get someone to come and try your app or to turn into a customer. And so that's where low lifetime value stuff doesn't tend to be ideal for paid advertising. And you need to look at things more like SEO, content marketing, virality, word of mouth, kind of the other marketing approaches.
So once you know what your target customer acquisition cost is, you have to start identifying the platforms that you're going to use. And there's a lot of different platforms out there. And it also depends a little bit on the specifics of whether or not you're going after desktop users or mobile users. But, you know, there's also like the standard ones for that kind of cross into both mobile and desktop, like Twitter, Facebook, AdWords, buy sell ads, and a number of other ones. I mean, Rob, I'm sure there's a list that you have taken a look at and have leveraged as well.
Yeah, boy, I had a list that was like a mile long when I was really hammering on this stuff with Hittail, and I ran on all types of kind of crappy B2C networks. It's like there's one called Chatika. To be honest, I don't even remember the names of the other ones because they were the ROI was so bad. I mean, I would pay $50 in ads, and you know, you'd get all these 10 cent clicks and no one would stay on their site more than 3 seconds, like none of them. And so instantly that was just, you know, a non-starter, because I knew if I spent 500, no one was going to stay on the site. There are a limited number of ad channels that you can think about if you are in the B2B space. You mentioned several of them. I would add LinkedIn. I would add AdWords, even though it's very expensive. It can be expensive. The Bing ad network is reasonable. YouTube is actually something I'm doing right now and I'm experimenting with. And then the other channel is retargeting, which kind of spreads across all of these channels. But retargeting is, while different than what we're talking about, we're talking about driving brand new traffic right now. But retargeting is something I would want to have in place before I ran these paid ads, because retargeting gives you a chance to then advertise to them again, and your conversion rates on those are going to be a lot better.
Yeah, that's a good point. But the one thing you do have to be careful about with retargeting is sometimes they have policies around, you have to have a product that people can reasonably buy. And sometimes if you are sending people directly to like a landing page and you can't buy from there, sometimes they get a little antsy about even allowing you to use their retargeting capabilities on like landing pages. So the next step is to run a series of tests on each platform for a specified amount of time. I'm partial to basically setting aside $100 and running the test for a week. And that's a very small test. I understand that it's probably not going to be representative, but at least it kind of dips your toes into the water, gets you at least a little bit comfortable with how that platform operates, what things you need to make those things work. You know, there's certain platforms like Twitter and Facebook, you can put in images into those advertisements. But when you're doing that, the requirements for those images are different sizes, and they will appear differently to the users based on whether or not it's showing up on the desktop or on a mobile device. And you know, you have to play around with those things a little bit. And when you're first setting these things up, it can take way more time than you ever thought imaginable to like just tweak your images and stuff like that to get them to show up, you know, inside the advertising platform. So it can be kind of a nightmarish process in terms of the amount of time that it takes, but you do still have to go through that process to figure out, you know, what is it that you need to do, and then be able to take those things and write them down and say, these are the requirements for this particular network, and then hand them off to like a graphic designer. And once you get through this, if you decide to double down on a platform, you can then take those requirements, hand them off to somebody and say, hey, I need you to build me images that go with this, this, and this, and these are the different sizes. And it allows you to kind of repeat the process in a way that is a lot more effective in terms of your time, as opposed to the first time where you're just trying to figure things out. You're trying to get familiar with it, get comfortable enough to be a little bit dangerous, and then from there you need to start optimizing. But you don't want to go through the process of trying to optimize before you even get started.
I second your surprise at how long it takes to set these things up. Every time I do paid acquisition, I think I'm just going to go in, buy a few ads, set up a budget, and be out. And it's always hours later, because I wind up finding images and crafting headlines and running all the split tests and doing all that type of stuff. So give more time to this than you think you're going to need. It is not a shortcut like any other marketing approach.
Yeah, like 3 or 4 times as much time as you think you need.
Yep, exactly. The other thing I would do probably before I ran a test, if you haven't done much paid acquisition, is to pick a single channel, pick one of these, and I would educate myself. I would dive deep into it. I would probably buy a course either on, you know, Mixergy Premium or Udemy, you know, from AppSumo. I've taken courses on all those. There are some really nice experts that give you some good insight into how to work the system. Or if, you know, you can even find like an actual expert on it. So like Amy Porterfield is an example, is a Facebook ads expert. And so I've bought a course from her on how to improve my Facebook ads. Or if you find, you know, a good blogger, good podcast on the topic, typically they are monetizing that by selling a paid course on whatever topic you want, Twitter ads or AdWords. That's what I would do. And that's what I have done. So when I started really doubling down on Facebook ads with Hittail, I bought like 4 or 5 Kindle books. I listened to several podcasts and I bought some paid video courses, and I went through all the material quickly. I didn't spend weeks doing it. I mean, I did this all in like one day. I skimmed through the books. I tried to find out the things that people were saying in common and the differences. And you can find yourself almost becoming a like expert by proxy if you just immerse yourself quickly and give yourself like an instant PhD in that technology just by hearing a bunch of stuff. Then you go in, you use all the best practices that you developed, and you hammer on a test. Now, you said do a small test, $100 in a week. I tend to want to move faster than that, and I will throw more money at it. I might budget $100 a day and sit there and watch it. And because I want to know quickly if this is going to work or not, you know, and if I get 4 or 5 days into it, I've spent a decent amount of money and I can start to tell if there's a, where the trend line is going. When I've made paid acquisition work in the past, it typically is an investment of a couple $1,000s before I'm starting to become confident in my ability to execute on it. And sometimes it's more than that. But that's in my head kind of a mental marker that I use of like, yeah, I might get a few grand into this before I really know if it's going to work.
Got it. Yeah. See, I run them kind of in parallel at the same time on multiple channels. Maybe at some point I would get a little bit more confident and say, you know, dump $100 a day into like 3 or 4 or 5 different channels at the same time. But I also found that trying to flip back and forth between the different ones and keep track of which ones were performing and which ones weren't, you could easily rack up a pretty hefty advertising bill in just inside of a week if you're paying $100 a day on 5 different channels.
That's the thing. I only test one channel at a time because I need to be an expert on it. Like, I can't become an expert on 5 channels and then try to run them parallel or else I'm running around like a chicken with no head. When I do a channel, I immerse, I focus on that channel for maybe a solid week and I don't really do anything else except for, I mean, I do my other projects and stuff, but I don't try to scatter myself. And then if that channel doesn't work, then I can move on to the next one. If it does work, then you can start trying to figure out that repeatable process of how am I going to run this long term? Because I'm not going to spend 20 hours a week on this every week, even though this week getting it set up and monitoring every, I mean, I would literally monitor every couple hours, like log in, look at it, see what's going to do, stop ads, start new ones. You know, I was really into it. Again, I'm not saying this is the only way to do it. This is how I do it. I like to dive into things anyways and be pretty intense about them and find out very quickly if it's going to work or not, rather than taking, you know, a more hands-off approach like I think you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you have a different approach to it than I did, where what I did was, as I said, I would run several of them in parallel. And then after that week, I basically look at the channel that I thought was performing the best and then essentially double down on that one and optimize it. So I ran through an ad and I compared Twitter against Facebook ads. And I found out that Twitter was performing about 4 times better than what Facebook was. And then I went in and I optimized the Twitter campaign and I essentially doubled conversion rate on the Twitter campaign. So at the end of the day, I basically made it 8 times better than what I was getting on Facebook. Clearly, there's different ways of doing it. I think it depends on how much time you have to play with and how much your budget is and how quickly you want to move forward with the paid advertising.
Yeah, that's a good point. When I did run through, there was a point where I ran through, I think, about 12 ad networks in the span of maybe 3 or 4 weeks, which means I obviously did do some of them in parallel. And what I did was the bigger ones that had more information about them and that I thought would, I just had more confidence they would work. Those are the ones that I dove into and I only did those one at a time, right? So that was like AdWords and Facebook. Whereas the ones like that, you know, the B2C ones I was talking about, 7Click and Chatika and these kind of weird things, I would, and even Bing ads, I would set them up and let them run in parallel because there isn't, it's not like there was a way to become a master at those. You just kind of had to throw it out and see what was going to happen. So I did do more parallel stuff with the things I didn't think were going to work as well.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So the next step in this process is to document everything that you're doing so that you're able to refer back to it later. I use a combination of things like screenshots and spreadsheets and Google Docs. Pretty much anything that I need to be able to come back and recreate it or ask questions in the future. And I do that for a couple of reasons. Partly is just so that I can acquire that information and set it to the side so that it acts as a true snapshot. And partly because I don't necessarily trust the platforms to not change underneath me so that if I need to find something later on, I can do it. And some of them actually make it very difficult to go in and tweak some of your settings. I remember back when Facebook was still making a ton of changes to their advertising network, there were things that would just break every other day. So I kind of learned quickly to just take screenshots and make it so that you could go back and do it again. That's not to say that you need to document everything heavily, just make sure that you're taking screenshots so that if you take a screenshot of like the demographic information that you're going to be targeting for one advertising network, it's a lot easier to just go refer to the screenshot than it is to go there, log in, and try and compare it to another network that you're trying to advertise on.
Yeah, I haven't done a good job of this step of documenting things. I typically leave it in the system where it's in. You know, if it's in the Facebook ad system, I'll refer back to it and go and try to look for trends and I'll graph stuff. And I do review the data and see who's clicking and optimizing stuff. But I don't think I have a single external doc that documents anything that is shared with anyone, because I've pretty much done most of the ad stuff myself. Now, with that said, if I was going to be outsourcing this or even having someone in my team do it, we would need some kind of way to communicate and document the tests we were running so that we could share our findings, right? There's this concept of a growth sprint. And it's similar to the like the coding sprints with Scrum. It's like a 1 to 2 week, or it can be a 30 to 90 day thing of trying to grow, you know, grow your company by using a single tactic. And so if you do a growth sprint with Facebook ads, however long that takes, you really want to document the experiments you're running and what you're learning from them so that you can share them with others. To date, like I said, I've not been very good at this and I've kept it all in my head. So if I was going to pass it on to someone else, I would have a bit of documentation to do beforehand.
Well, I think that also kind of goes back to, you know, the difference between how you have done it and how I've done it. Whereas you do like that really hard deep dive into it, into like one advertising network, where I'll kind of step back and do things a lot slower and compare the networks against each other. And in that case, I kind of need those screenshots in order to make it easier for me to be able to compare between the two. Versus if you're kind of going deep in one particular network, it's not as important because you're tweaking within that network and you typically have all the information kind of right there at your fingertips, and you can, you know, just look at it. Depends on how much you think you need to document some of that stuff too. The other thing I like to do is compare the results from one platform against each other. And I think that the best way to do this is to make sure that your advertising is as similar between the different platforms as possible. But do keep in mind that there are going to be differences between like advertising on LinkedIn versus on Facebook or on Twitter, because just partially because of intent, but partially because of the audience as well. So you might say one thing to the people on LinkedIn and something different to the people on Twitter. And another thing I like to do is, as I said before, you know, comparing against like Twitter and Facebook, double down on what's working or try to optimize it. I found that on Twitter, I was able to, you know, it did 4 times as well as Facebook right out of the gate. And I found that, you know, using like the Twitter cards, for example, I could essentially double my conversion rate by essentially eliminating steps by forcing people to click on the advertisement and then go over to a landing page and then enter their information. With the Twitter cards, it's literally one click. You can just click a button that says learn more and send my information, you know, over to Mike Tabor for what he's working on. And I found that by getting rid of those extra steps, you know, it doubled my conversion rate on that.
Yeah, the thing to keep in mind when you're doing paid acquisition is it's a lot harder than you think it is. Like you don't just set up an ad and instantly have positive ROI. It takes work. It takes optimization. It takes comparison. I mean, we're recording a whole episode here and we're barely touching the surface of the amount of not only upfront optimization, but kind of the ongoing work it takes to run an ongoing campaign, you know, because the ads burn out and that kind of stuff. So keep that in mind as you're embarking on this, that the nice part about paid advertising is it's very quick, right? It's like instant ramp up, instant ramp down, like a faucet you can turn on and off. And it scales really well if you can make it work, because any of these channels that we're talking about are pretty highly scalable. But the downside is that it often will not work for you. A lot of channels just won't convert, and you will spend some money that kind of you'll never get back, and you won't have a positive ROI on that.
So let's talk about some general thoughts on paid advertising. One thing that you just mentioned was ad burnout. Why don't you expand a little bit on that, on exactly what ad burnout is before?
Sure. I mean, the idea is that ads have a certain lifetime, and over that lifetime, you'll see this gradual decay of click-through rates and of results, because people basically get blindness to your ad. So if you use the same image for months at a time, over time, that click-through rate will just naturally fall. So you can't just, as a rule, post an ad and expect it to work forever. Now, there are some exceptions to this. AdWords is one where you don't tend to need to renew your ads because it's intent-based, right? It's search-based. And so the people who are seeing it tend to be new people all the time seeing it. And that's a good thing. If you're on Facebook and you're targeting a demographic, then someone who's interested in email marketing will see that same ad over and over. And over time, even if they clicked it once, they'll become blind. Your audience is so big and you need to, you know, change it up. So that's the idea. Ad blindness, ad rot, ad burnout. It's all the same idea. It's that the performance of your ads will decay over time.
going back to what I talked about in terms of documenting things, one thing that I've seen is that the ad networks that I've worked with don't tend to track what your conversion rate is over time. Because of ad burnout, you kind of have to do it yourself, because all they do is they give you this raw number and it's, you know, within this snapshot of time, or it's like the total amount of time that you've been running the ad, and it'll just be a number. So if you're not paying attention to what that number is yesterday and the day before and the week before that, then it can slowly drop over time and you don't notice. So that's something else that you kind of have to keep in mind. As I said before, in terms of being able to drive people to a landing page, it's very helpful. And if there's any way to kind of bypass that process or to shorten the entire time that it takes in order to acquire somebody's email address, then that's definitely an avenue that you should explore and look at. I mean, like I said, on Twitter, I was able to double my conversion rate just by using the lead cards, as opposed to sending somebody to a landing page and then they have to, you know, enter in their information.
Right, and Google AdWords has that same capability where you can capture an email right there in the ad. I have never actually tried that, so I don't know if it's effectiveness, but I'd imagine if someone's interested, it's probably a decent way to go.
Another option you have is that if you have an email list already, so if you have an existing product where you've got customers and you've got information about them, like their email address, then you can take those lists of email addresses and upload them to some of these ad networks. And what they use is something called related audiences. And essentially what you do is you are going to be able to target people who are like that list of email addresses that you uploaded. I know that Facebook does this, Twitter does this. I don't know if Google Ads does this or not.
I don't think it does.
What it does is it allows you to target other people for advertising who are like your current audience. And that's extremely helpful.
Yeah, so it's similar to retargeting, right? Where like retargeting, you are essentially targeting based on the action that someone has taken, which is visiting your website. In this sense, you are targeting a specific group because they are demographically similar to your audience, to people who've actually signed up for it. And demographically similar, I'll put in quotes, because that's Twitter or Facebook's judgment call, right? They have these algorithms, and so they have the social graph where they can link people together and see similar folks. And so they're just gonna, it's kind of a black box for you, but you get the recommendations based on that. I've used the related audience stuff in Facebook. I have not had luck with it, but I have heard that it is doing very well for some folks.
It hasn't worked nearly as well for me, but I do know some people who are making it work extremely well. Something else you can pay attention to is any sort of related information you can get from the different advertising networks. So if you can get age or location or demographic or platform information, you can zero in on those particular things, and some of them are going to convert better for you. And I haven't figured out exactly why that is. You know, so for example, I'm running a Twitter advertising campaign right now, and the people who are using Android devices are converting more than twice as well as people who are using iOS devices, which is kind of bizarre.
I've used this quite a bit, especially on Facebook. I found out that there was a certain age bracket that converted better. There are like 14 states in the US that convert way, way better, like two or three times better than all the other states. I didn't notice anything with platforms in particular, like you said, but you can get these out of the, you know, out of the Facebook ad platform. Once someone clicks on stuff, once you run some ads, then you can go back and see who clicked on it most and kind of narrow your demographics. Now, this means you can't scale this ad up as well because you're starting to exclude people, so you won't get as much traffic even once you ratchet your budget all the way up. But those will be your highest ROI clicks, and so early on that's what you want to shoot for. Then later on, if you are exceeding your ROI, you can always dial those back a little bit. You can widen that age range, or you can go to those states that maybe don't convert as well when you're really trying to scale it up and drive the maximum amount of traffic.
So another thing that I found is that do not trust the metrics that they're giving you. You have to take anything that they're telling you with a grain of salt, especially when it comes to Facebook and Twitter, because they use what is referred to as an engagement, which is not necessarily a conversion for you. And the other issue that I found is that their idea of a lead and yours can be wildly different, depending on whether they're counting out just based on a click or, you know, all the way through, you know, your acquisition funnel to get an email address, you know, also whether or not they're charging you for that lead or not. There are some ads that you can run that can be shared, for example, and depending on whether or not it was showed to somebody and then they clicked through it and you were charged for it, or if they shared it and one of their friends clicked through and signed up for it, you might be charged for the first one, but not the second one. And that skews your numbers. So be really, really careful about how you're looking at a lot of those numbers and make sure you fully understand exactly what it is that you're interested in, whether it's email addresses or impressions or actual sales all the way through the sales funnel. It really depends on, you know, why it is that you're running these ads as to, you know, the specifics of what you're looking at.
Yeah, I agree with this one. I've seen some folks, you know, touting the Facebook newsfeed ads over the right-hand side ads because you get more clicks, or the clicks are cheaper, I guess is what it is, and the click-through rate is higher. But if you actually look at what a click means for a newsfeed ad, it means someone clicking any link on that ad, and there's like 5 or 6 links. So if you're trying to drive them off-site to your website, half of those links or more don't go to your website. They go to like your Facebook page or like some other random place. It's completely not useful for you, not going to contribute to your conversions, but they count that as a click and you get charged for it. And then on the right-hand side ads, you know, any link there is actually going to lead off-site to your website. So every click there is a real click to your website. So like you said, Mike, I mean, these things, they can be misleading. I hope they're not being intentionally misleading, but it has felt like that to me at times where the numbers don't really add up because of the way they're defining certain things like clicks.
It's complicated because your perspective as somebody who's buying these ads is going to be different than their perspective as somebody who is creating the mechanism for you to run the advertisements. If any of the advertising platforms reach out to you and offer any sort of a one-on-one, a free one-on-one to help you improve your advertising, definitely take them up on the offer. It gives you the ability to ask them, you know, in-depth questions about exactly how things work, and you can start questioning the numbers that you're coming back with. Or that they're coming back with, and ask them, hey, what does this mean? Or I saw this, and this is, these numbers don't add up. Why do they not add up? And you can start getting an in-depth description or explanation directly from them about why some of those things don't add up. Sometimes it's very helpful, and sometimes you look at it, and you know, they'll look at it, and they'll say, yeah, we know, we've heard that a number of times, and this is sort of how you can get around it. So sometimes they do have workarounds for you, but it's, you know, it's always worth it to take the time to follow up on those things, be able to get in front of them and ask them the questions directly so you can get answers directly from the vendor.
Yeah, I would agree with that. They seem like they might be a waste of time, but I agree. If there's quirks in the system, these are the folks who know it, and these are the folks who can alert you to it. I did let Google at one point, they wanted to like optimize one of my campaigns. So they copied it and asked if they could create an optimized version based on their best practices. And this was 3 or 4 years ago, probably. And it was an AdWords campaign. And I ran theirs along with mine, and theirs was awful. It was horrendous. It was spending a ton of money. You know, the budget was high. Wasn't getting many clicks. Wasn't getting conversions. And I eventually stopped it. And I don't know what the story was, because I genuinely expected them to have the knowledge to be able to do this better. But the campaigns I had running were far superior to it. So I think in terms of that, which is super specific advice, I think take it with a grain of salt and watch if they do run it, you know, optimize a campaign for you or whatever. You just need to watch it and compare like anything else. But just in terms of meeting with them, like you said, and getting advice on the platform and all that, I think that's a worthwhile hour that you could spend on the phone with them. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.